Oh, wait, this evening. In here, it looks like night. This evening, it gives me great pleasure to introduce Professor Johan Sagan from the University of Illinois, Chicago. Yesterday, we heard from Bernard Madison all the things we need. And today, we'll hear from Johan Sagan how to get Johan Sagan. Lessons from the Singapore curriculum.
Hey, good evening. Thank you very much for inviting me here, and I'm very honored to speak to this interesting group of people. Now, stories about the Singapore curriculum have appeared in various aspects of the U.S. media, from the Washington Post, the Christian Science Monitor, the Associated Press, National Public Radio, Education Week, and other organs. Part of the reason that the story has captured the public imagination is that it is a very curious story. Some educators, myself included, claim that the United States, with huge resources, with the most expensive educational system in the world, should learn how elementary school mathematics should be taught from a very small country in a corner of Southeast Asia. The current U.S. administration seems to agree. It signed the bilateral agreement of cooperation in mathematics and science education with Singapore, so that it would look like a two-way street. The agreement says that Singapore will help the United States with mathematics education, and the United States will help Singapore with science education. You see, Singapore, which came first in the world in mathematics education, came second in the world in science education. Now, the Singapore educational system gained recognition in 1996-97 when the results of the third international math and science study came out. Scores for fourth grade were Singapore was first with 625. The absolute numbers don't matter, it's just the relative standing. Followed by Korea with 611, Japan with 597. The United States came 12th with 545. The international average, which was for 27 countries, was 529. And now I claim that what happened with this was a minor miracle. The results for fourth grade appeared 4 to 6 weeks before the results for eighth grade. And so the fact that the United States was ever so slightly above average was celebrated. It's the U.S. Secretary of Education, which was Riley at the time, all the honchos of the NCTM had a news conference saying, whoopee, we are above average. Now, everybody that is at all familiar with American mentality, I've never seen a sports team saying, whoopee, we are above average. We say, we are number one, or you keep silent and wait till next year. But what happened next, however, was that the eighth grade result appeared. Singapore was again first, and with a larger margin over number two, 643. Japan and Korea changed places. Japan was number two with 607. Korea with 605, Hong Kong with 588. The US came 28th from 41 nations. Now, if you, to me, the most significant number is the comparison between the 26 countries that took both fourth and eighth grade. It appears under in the list under the in the column under the sublist for eighth grade. So if you take the sublist of the countries that took both tests, the United States slipped from the 12th position in fourth grade to the 18th position in eighth grade. Why is that such a significant number? The absolute location of a country can be, quote unquote, explained by extra school factors. So the apologists for the failures of US educational system say, oh, we have a more heterogeneous society. Which is a cold word, we have more black students. They say we have more children from families with only one parent, children raised by a mother or a father, mostly a mother, of course. And therefore we cannot hope to compete with country X or country Y. They also say, if we compare our results to, say, a country populated with a Chinese population, we have to compete with Chinese culture, which places much higher emphasis on learning than does ours. All of this, however, gets washed out when you compare fourth and eighth grade. There are no more, I mean, there is not a greater heterogeneity in the eighth grade than there is in fourth grade. You cannot claim that there are more children, a higher percentage of the children growing up in a single parent family. There is not a great difference between fourth grade US culture and eighth grade US culture. The drop from 12th to 18th position is an indictment of the US educational system. The longer the kids are in school, the further they are behind. Now, you must be curious how Canada fared in these comparisons. Whereas the education system in the United States fails miserably, the Canadian system is consistently mediocre. Of the 26 countries that took both fourth and eighth grade, Canada was 13th, which is dead center, in the fourth grade, and up one level to 12th in eighth grade. I myself would not be happy with such results. Now, I started studying the Singapore curriculum in 1998, together with a group of public school high school teachers. I have been studying the Singapore curriculum for grades 7 through 10, which is high school in Singapore, and with a different group of Chicago public schools elementary and middle school teachers, I have been studying the Singapore curriculum for grades 1 through 6. I also worked from August 1998 until December 1999 with the Ingenuity Project in the city of Baltimore. This is a project in three public middle schools and one public high school in Baltimore. The results there indicate that using the Singapore curriculum with proper support for the teachers can result in substantial improvements in student outcomes. The project is evaluated each year by the Center for Talented Youth of Johns Hopkins University. It's a highly professional and very highly respected Department of College of Education, and the Center for Talented Youth is essentially unique in the United States in the work that it is doing. The center was examining the students in the project at the beginning and at the end of each year. In the 5 years preceding 1998, the percentile standing, the raw scores are not an interesting number, but the percentile standing of students in the projects did not change from the beginning of the year to the end of the year. In spite of substantial sums of money that were poured into the project by the Abel Foundation. In fact, when I came in, they were facing the real possibility of being closed at the end of the year. The evaluators in the previous year said that this is a project not for gifted students, but for good students, that concentrating good students in classrooms should produce a percentile improvement independent of the additional resources and of the method of teaching, simply because of peer pressure to do more. And nothing was happening. Let me share with you the outcome of the first year for the use of the Singapore books in Baltimore. Needless to say, but I'll say it anyway, I had nothing to do with the evaluation. In fact, I haven't seen the evaluation throughout the year that the type of exams that the students were given, I haven't seen it before. Until after it was given. And so there was absolutely no teaching to the exam, and when I looked at the exam, I have to tell you that I was struck by our students answering questions that we had no right to expect them to answer. This is apropos the running argument that took place in this conference about the effect of exams on the teaching. There was no effect of the exam on the teaching. What we did in every case was decide what's the right thing to do. So let me talk not about individual schools but about the composite results. Sixth grade students started the school year on the 83rd percentile and ended it in the 91st percentile. Seventh grade students started the year in the 87th percentile and ended it in the 93rd percentile. What is particularly important to note is that, and this you can see from the individual school results, that lower achieving students had larger gains than higher achieving students. You see, the point is that all kinds of educational initiatives, so to speak, make the rich richer and the poor poorer. Better students are better equipped to take advantage of the additional instruction and of the additional challenges, and they improve typically more than the weaker students who actually need the additional help. So the spread between high achieving and low achieving students actually diminished as a result of this work. For the eighth grade, the results were, I had absolutely nothing to do with the evaluation tools and with the way that they were reported. But if you look, let me raise it a little bit so that it is. Clearer to see. There are reports on the fourth on the four quartiles, and on a subset of the fourth quartile, which is a 97th to 99th percentile. The reason that that is separated is that I think is that 97th to 99th percentile is defined as gifted. So if we take the best school, school number one, it started with no students in that range and ended with more than half the students in that range. More than half the students. If we take school number three, school number two, which is the lowest performing school, no, school number three, where two-thirds of the students started on the lowest quartile, that percent declined to just over one-fifth of the students, let's say a quarter of the students in that unfortunate quartile, etc. So the results for the eighth grade were quite as striking as for grades 6 and 7. I'm not reporting on grades 9 and 10 because I do not recommend Singapore materials for grades 9 and 10, and we were not using Singapore materials there. There was improvement there also, but essentially the use of the Singapore books revitalized the teachers even in classes that were not using Singapore books. Now, last year I worked as a consultant with a K through 4 charter school in Phoenix. They evaluated themselves by taking the Stanford 9 exam, which is the standard exam taken by all public schools in Phoenix. So we evaluated third and fourth grade students only because what we were interested in is a change in percentile standing, not where they were. So third grade students improved from the 90th percentile to the 86.2 percentile, and continuing fourth grade students advanced from the 85.5 percentile to the 94.7 percentile. Not a single student in the fourth grade had a decline in his percentile standing. Everybody improved, or at least stayed the same. The results in Baltimore were on all students. The charter school, since it's not selective, we omitted one student which was classified as special ed and had more time to do the test and could talk with the teacher during taking the test, etc. Several other special ed students elected to take the test together with the regular students under identical conditions and did very well. Now, let me emphasize again, when you interpret these results, please take into consideration that they were not the instruments were not aligned with the Singapore curriculum. They were not measuring the full depth of understanding of the students. They were measuring very superficial aspects of the students' learning. And my my personal interpretation of it, and I know the students very well, they are a reflection not only of improved understanding, but even more importantly, a change in attitude from a passive attitude to an attitude can do. The students felt that they can do, that they can handle anything that comes their way, anything mathematical that comes their way. I have to put one more caveat into it. You see, all of you, or many of you, know there is no pure experiment in education. You are not going to withhold for the, you know, you are not going to hold parameters fixed so as to measure a single parameter. So at the same time that, I mean, this refers to the work in Phoenix more than the work in Baltimore. At the same time that there was a change in the textbooks and in the method, there was also intervention by me as to ways of teaching, etc. So the results should be taken with some caution. However, I have to tell you, these are not the only two venues where I was working with American schools and Singapore books, and the results are not much different than what I think would have been the results in the other places, except the school didn't bother to measure them. Now, when I share my opinions on the Singapore books with people, I invariably get asked, what makes them so good? And the answer is very probably very disappointing to people who believe in silver bullets. There is no single aspect that we could lift out from these books, put it in our books, and make our books good. Rather, it is a list of simple, I would say, changes that are, however, consistent, build upon each other, and the totality, the gestalt of these changes produces the results that we are talking about. Now, how are they different than US books? All US books I have ever seen have loads of extraneous information on each page. Let me give you an example from the book that changed my mind about book burning. This is the most popular algebra book in the United States. Makes loads of money to the publishing house. So on page 145, chapter on Cramer's rule in the margin. Global connections. Malaysian foot tennis is a very popular sport in Malaysia and other countries in the Far East. It is played by teams of two using a volleyball type net. A ball woven from rattan must be kept in the air using only feet, knees, or thighs. There is no connection whatever between this paragraph and anything else in the book. Mathematics is easy if you focus on it. I would go further. One of the important benefits of a proper education in mathematics is an increased ability to concentrate on a task. The authors of the Glencoe book do their best to diffuse the focus. Can you imagine an English text, say a Shakespeare play, having this paragraph in the margins? No, since the publisher assumes the students would find the English text sufficiently interesting. Obviously, the authors and the publishers of the Glencoe II book thought that the students working their way through their book would need relief from the mathematics. From the same chapter on the margin of page 141, why it's important. You can use Cramer's rule to solve problems involving sports and politics. This is just phony. Students justifiably lose respect for the book and unfortunately for the subject matter itself. In contrast, the Singapore books have a page layout which concentrates the focus on mathematics. The only figures in the margins are drawings of children with balloons coming out of their mouth, in which you have hints on how to do, on how to think of different problems. There is nothing except mathematics there. Now, let us talk a little bit about the contents of the books. Again, as I said, many good ideas. And let me share with you some of the simplest ideas I learned from the Singapore curriculum. Now, many teachers in the room, I am sure if I ask you what are the two troublesome topics in elementary school mathematics, the majority would say two things, fractions and word problems. So, let's talk a moment about fractions. In the United States, for some reasons, fractions are discussed in connection with the division of pizzas. The division of a circle into two, four, or eight parts is not hard. Three parts is harder. I cannot divide a circle roughly into five equal parts without using a protractor and calculating 360 divided by 5 equals 72. By now, I have already solved a problem which is harder than the problem I wanted to illustrate. Singapore does pizzas too, I think, in obeisance to some international mode, but it also does rectangles. So when I work with teachers in the United States, I always tell them cakes, not pies. See, cakes are rectangular, pies are round. This is rectangles are much easier to divide. You require only a ruler. Moreover, the degree measure of a circle cannot be manipulated. If I want to divide the circle into seven equal parts, I'm in trouble. The rectangle is malleable. I can make it as long or as wide as is convenient for the measurement. So if I need to divide it into seven equal parts, I'll draw the rectangle so that one of the dimensions will measure a number that's divisible by seven and be done with it. Now, but the real advantage of rectangles over circles is in the demonstration of operations on fractions. What is two-fifths of 1/6? Try to illustrate the answer to this with a circle. If you find a satisfactory drawing for it, please show it to me. I'd like to see it. How is it done with a rectangle? With a rectangle, you have a second discernible dimension. So, let me demonstrate to you what is 2/5 of 1/6. I'll try to talk louder here because there is no microphone. You draw a rough triangle, and I need to firstly show you what is 1/6. Okay, I'll divide it into 6 equal parts. And every child will tell you that this is 1/6. Right? And now I need to divide it into 5 parts. Okay, this is where the second dimension, the second discernible dimension comes in. I divide it into 5 parts in the vertical direction. When I work with teachers and with students, I have them count with me. So, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. And you have to count like this, because otherwise they'll count one too many. Right? Okay. So, here is 1/5, right? And we need 1/6, and we need 2/5 of it, and each one of them is 1/5 of it, right? And so 2/5 of it are these two, I illustrate with these two rectangles, okay? So, 2/5 of 1/6 is 2 out of how many? And if it's third grade, we count. If it's a higher grade, they know. It's 30. Okay? Now, 2 over 30, we want to simplify. What do we want to simplify it? We want to simplify it to 1 over 15. Now, how do we simplify? Why is 2 over 30 is 1 over 15? Now, American teachers, all of them, will tell you this is 2 times 1 divided by 2 times 15. Cancel, cancel, we have 1 over 15. What is the problem with this operation? This is what I call a brain bypass operation. You do it because the teacher will give you full credit for it. The student does not know what he's doing. And this, well, when I say this to the teachers, they say, they never have any trouble with it. Of course, but the student that does not have any trouble with this operation, very frequently also does not have any trouble with this operation. This is meaningless, this is meaningless. And they look the same, right? How can you justify the operation using the Singapore method? You say, I am forming a new unit. The new unit will be 2 rectangles inside. This is 1 unit. Here is another one such unit. Here is another one such unit. Okay? I'm not dividing into the... Now, the fact that 2 is a common factor to the integer in the numerator and the integer in the denominator says that there will be an integer number of units in the marked part and an integer number in the whole. Therefore, I'm going to get an integer divided by an integer, in other words, the reduced fraction. And now the operation of the reduction of the fraction is an operation that is done with full understanding and in a way which is completely intuitive to the student and that is memorable. It is memorable because the student is doing it as part, you know, operating with full understanding each step of the way. Is the point clear? Good. Let us look at another example. What is 2/5 plus 1/6? A rectangle. So I divide it this way into 5 parts. Imagine that they are equal. Descartes would be upset, but it cannot be helped. So, 2/5 plus 1/6. Okay, I'm going to divide the other dimension into 6 parts. Now, 2/5 are these. Right? And 1/6. 1/6 is one row, and I don't have a whole row. So what I'm saying is, these two that I needed, I'll take them somewhere else. Okay? Now, how many rectangles do I have marked? 17 out of how many? 30. Done. Now, you might object that the first answer that you get in this method is going to have the product of the two denominators as the common denominator. And if you want the least common denominator, you need to reduce later. And I agree with you. And as a matter of fact, I had an exchange with Hang Shi Wu in Berkeley, who said, yes, that's the way you should teach fractions in elementary school. You don't need to get the best answer, just get the correct answer. There is a famous, very wise saying by Winston Churchill, which is, don't let the best be the enemy of the good. This is a good answer. The product of the denominators is a good answer. It's not the best, but don't let the best be the enemy of the good. Now, let me continue with a survey of word problems. And I thought you should be left with something in your hands at the end of the presentation. And so I have a handout of word problems from grade 3 through 6. In the Singapore curriculum. Now, none of them matches or even approximates in sophistication the problems we saw this morning. But bear in mind, these are regular homework problems for all students in Singapore. Streaming in Singapore starts after sixth grade. There is some streaming on language instruction. There is no streaming on math instruction until sixth grade. So, thank you very much. Let me ask somebody okay. There to give. Could you pass these? Take one. Very good. That's fine. You can take more than one. Don't need to give change. Now, let me start with what I would consider sort of a crowning piece of the Singapore method, and it was funny. The fourth grade teacher in Phoenix last year had a problem. She had two or three excellent students, sort of fourth grade version of the student, the Indian student we saw in the movie that was shown to us, that impressed me so much yesterday morning. And so I advised her to give Math Olympiad problem, Singapore Math Olympiad problems to these students. Singapore Math Olympiad is for graduates of sixth grade, and it is at the last problem at the bottom of the second page of the handout. So the ratio between the size and the side length of a rectangle is 3 to 5. The area of the rectangle is 288 square centimeters. What are the dimensions of the rectangle? Okay? So, the ratio of the sides is 3 to 8, and area... I beg your pardon?
3 to 5.
3 to 5, rather. The area is, thank you very much, 288 square centimeters. What are the dimensions? Now, here the students got stuck on it. They are fourth grade, even if they are very talented, and this is sixth grade and first in the world syllabus. Here is the intended solution. Okay, we'll take for one dimension 3 units, and for the second dimension, we'll take 5 units. And here is where we have. Here is where we are. Right? How many? Actually, it wasn't 288. I tried to reconstruct the problem. I did a bad job here. So it will not come out clean meaning with integers. But we can do it anyway. I'm sorry. We'll take it as it is. How many rectangles do we have here? 15. Therefore, what is the area of each rectangle? It's 288. Over 15. In the original problem, it was not only an integer, it was a square. You take the square root of it, this is the dimension, the side lengths of each of these square. So let's do it for grown-ups. This is beyond what was expected. Therefore, there are three of them in this dimension, so the one dimension is 3 square root of 288 over 15, and the other dimension is 5 square root 288 over 15, and these are the dimensions of the rectangle. When you give it to your students, change the 288. Okay? But the idea is clear. The point is that the solution is, you know, we are talking here about 12-year-olds. The solution with variables to them is much too abstract. Much too abstract. even if they go through the process correctly and get an answer and get some satisfaction, they are not operating with a good understanding. The drawing makes it possible for them to see the answer, not just get the answer. Let me take another example. By the way, the letters A and B indicate first and second semester. So 6A means first semester of sixth grade, 6B, second semester of sixth grade, etc. Let's take 6B, problem number 3. The ratio of Kasim's money to Paul's money was 5-2 at first. After Kasim gave $30 to Paul, they had an equal amount of money. How much money did they have altogether? Okay? So, Kasim had 5 units. Paul had 2 units. After Kasim gave $30 to Paul, they had an equal amount of money. So, you write, it's a bit of writing. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 minus 30 is equal to 1, 2 plus 30, right? And now we use a balance. We cross out 1, 2, 1, 2, and we say that 3 rectangles, that's what's left in the picture. We add 30 to both sides, is equal to 60. 1 rectangle is equal to 20. And now we know everything.
Don't say the solution method is presented as standard in the books.
Yes, it is. Okay. Just like this. Now, you would say correctly, why a square and not the letter X? The answer is because it works. It works with the children. The letter X is an additional level of abstraction. Now, if you look at this solution, the transition from the box to the letter X is easy. Is easy. At a certain point, you tell the students, it's too much trouble drawing the boxes. Let's do an X instead. And this is done in seventh grade, actually at the end of sixth grade, and the transition is completely seamless. Completely seamless. Now, I can show you, I mean, you have in the collection other examples like this. My experience was that in Chicago, cannot say anything about any other place, eighth grade teachers had great difficulty solving sixth grade regular Singapore textbooks problems. The chair of the department at Whitney Young School, which at the time was the flagship of the high schools in Chicago, took sixth grade problems, gave it to 10th graders in her school. This when the story broke out, I was in Israel, but a local television station did a 5-minute segment on Singapore books in Chicago. They sent a crew to the high school and interviewed the students there. 10th grade in the best high school in Chicago said, the problems are harder, but it really gives you satisfaction to solve them. 4 years older than the age of children in Singapore doing these problems for regular homework. Now, the results from Baltimore, from Phoenix, from other places clearly show that American students can do this, can learn this, provided they are challenged by their textbooks and given the tools to meet those challenges. And when I started in preaching the gospel 5 years ago, there were 4 schools in the United States that were using Singapore materials. Last time I asked, which was a year ago, there were 140. And this is still an insignificantly small number for the United States, but it is growing very fast these days. I thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much, Yaron. And he has been so clever to leave us 10 minutes to ask questions.
Oh.
Let's rescue day.
Yeah.
So, sorry. Yeah. And so let's enjoy those 10 minutes. Is it all right if I just to wake you guys up?
Oh, sure. Scott.
Yeah, because Tom. Sure. And Tom is one of our intimate friends, so we know what he said.
So how do you suggest that teachers here integrate the Singapore curriculum? Do we just buy the textbooks and go along with the textbooks, or what other things do we need to do
to make it successful? You don't need other things. Just use the textbooks.
And the teachers can learn those ways of solving the problems with the
textbooks? Well, the really important question is, can the students?
Sure. And that's how you deliver it.
That's right. I would strongly recommend help, getting help for the teachers. There are problems using the Singapore books. The first problem is their teacher guides are lousy. They really are bad.
Excuse me, what?
Lousy, bad.
What?
The teacher guides.
Oh, the teacher guides.
The teacher guides. I am sure that there are any number of mathematicians at UBC who would be able to decipher from the textbooks themselves how to do it.
So the textbooks display those solutions?
Yes, 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 yes.
Okay, so in your section 5, you've got 3/5 of something and 3/8 of the remainder. Is that the first time?
Yeah, sorry, what should I be looking at?
5A, your first problem there was like 3/5 to white and 3/8 of the remainder. So, and you gave an example of case where you have 2/5 of 1/6.
You know what, let me do 5A number 1, let me do it.
No, I just want to know what grade.
Oh, 5th grade.
Well, on the cakes, not pies, you said the example you gave of the rectangle is 2/5 of 1/6. What grade do they do that in Singapore?
I wish I remembered. I don't want...
To me, like, it would be
I don't...
Four.
Yeah. Could be.
And that's what it looks like.
Yeah.
Because in grade 5, they have to do 3/5 of something and 3/8 of something else.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah. But...
Maybe not.
I'm sorry, I did not bring with me the full collection, so I cannot look at it.
I'm just trying to figure out where to place 2/5 of 1/6, where to reposition it properly in our curriculum, because it's not.
Oh, it's not there.
It's right now it's in green.
I will tell you something. My feeling about questions like this is as follows. The method that I have shown now, what age students here could digest it, that's when you give it to them. I mean,
why would it be any difference anywhere else?
That's fine, but have yeah, but have the, you know, have, I'll give you my email, I'll answer the question after I look it up, because I don't want to give an answer that is not...
At least grade 5 or grade 6 here, I would say. Yeah. It's not needed for that 5A problem. That 5A problem is integers. You go straight to 2^11 and to 3/8
to 2/4. Fractions.
No, no, it's not, but it's done, when it's done graphically, here is... Here, let me do this. You will find it, you know, it's not the way I, Tony, it's not the way I would explain it to you, but to the children, here is a $600, right? He gave 3/5 of it to his wife, so 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. And 3/5 he gave to his wife. This reminds me a joke, I'll tell you in a moment. And 3/8 of the remainder he spent. So here is 1/2, 1/4, 1/8, 1/8, 1/4, 1/8, 1/8. Now, 3/8 of the remainders, right? So, this comes here. So, 1/8 of the remainder is 2 of them. So, 3/8 is 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Right? How many, how much money did he spend? So, how this is $600. We have 8 by 5, that's 40. We have 40 rectangles here. Therefore, each rectangle is 600 over 40, that's 15. And how much money did he spend? We counted, we have 8, 16, 24, 27, 30. So $450 he spent. This is a way that a Singapore student would do it.
Very similar to the 2/5 of 1/6.
That's right. That's right. It's, and it is important to do it in a consistent way so that the students acquire the habit.
So you probably do the 2/5 of 1/6 before you do the word problem.
Yes.
Right? Because the skill comes before the application. Is there, I don't know.
Yeah.
Yeah, but you continue your discussion later because
no, but I promised a joke.
Yes, but then I promised Tom that he still got some time.
Shall we take a shall we take a vote?
No. Of course, we all want.
You
to
don't
hear
want to hear what I've got to say.
Yeah, okay. No.
Oh, so
maybe never mind. I'll remind me. I'll tell you.
I'll
you. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, first of all, I'd like to say, you said you promised us that we're going to learn from the curriculum, but it seems that we're going to learn from the books, which brings us down to the things I've said earlier before. It's obviously not the curriculum that makes, what causes this, but it's the method which you...
Oh, yes, yes.
That's important. And I don't say this because I'm a textbook writer, but it's a nice coincidence. Another thing what I'd like to say, which shocks me a little bit, when I was in Australia, I was in the International Classroom Research Center, and I had access there to videos, 30 lessons, consecutive lessons in algebra, where Japan, Hong Kong was one of the countries, United States, Germany, etc., Australia. What you could see there is such a different culture in the way lessons were given, that to me, it's a bit naive almost to say that if you take Singapore, which is number one, and to think that the methods they use in Singapore can be replaced in America, because the culture difference is so great. What happens is, and of course you're satisfied with your results, the first time we met we agreed already to have a fundamental disagreement, so I can say...
Yeah, but we don't have to spend all our time looking for it.
No, we want to hear the joke.
No. What I'm saying is, when I wrote textbooks, I did experiments with them on my own students. My results were much higher than from the teachers who didn't write the books. The same may appear here. You are coaching these teachers, and you are getting a lot into this, so he knew what was going on. Which means that maybe that may have a very positive effect on the results. So what I'm trying to say is that just copying things, not taking into account what kind of a culture it comes from, seems to me like a bit of a...
I will tell you something. I didn't discuss it with you. I've used these books in black ghetto schools on the south side of Chicago. They work like charm there. The reason is that the books talk, this has to do with other educational principles, not necessarily even mathematical. But the book talk to the children in the language of the children. They are written in simple English, mostly because they are written for their entire audience has English as a second language. Their entire audience. So the language is simple, direct, no four color pictures, simple drawings. The children feel at home with the books. And I cannot imagine a larger cultural difference than the ones between those classrooms and Singapore classrooms. Now, you know, to conduct a proper educational experiment is expensive, and the schools are not interested in it. I have results from two occasions where the schools were interested in it. But as I said before, my judgment is that the results were similar where they were not measured. Now, what you said is deeply true. You cannot teach different students in the same way. You cannot. And as a matter of fact, I wasn't going to get into it. But, you know, one of the wonderful things in being an educational consultant is people pay you and teach you at the same time. So I learned how to work with direct instruction and with what is called precision teaching. And we can sit together and talk about what these are. And the combination of these two techniques with the Singapore books actually enhances the outcomes. The results from Baltimore do not reflect it because I didn't know it then. The results from Phoenix do reflect it, and the results, which are undocumented, but from the black schools in Chicago, do reflect it. And the funny thing is, I was this year and last year in the annual conference of Core Knowledge. You may have heard of them. It's a wonderful organization in the United States, founded by E.D. Hirsch. And somebody heard that I was talking about Singapore. He said, oh, I got something from Singapore. And he gave me a reprint of a talk by a high official in Singapore Ministry of Education. And it was written there, it was just like a miracle. He said, it is true that we came first in the world, and it is true that we have the best books in the world, but there are two things we can learn from the United States. It's direct instruction and precision teaching. Just like that. Now, I am not, how should I say, in education it is important to keep in mind everything is a tool. Everything is a tool. And like every tool, it has to be used appropriately. So, I always say to a man who has only a hammer, every problem looks like a nail. So you have to have a whole toolbox and use those tools that are appropriate to the job. These books are a wonderful tool that, to my knowledge, can be used in most situations, perhaps even all situations, but they have to come in combination with other tools.
Thank you.
but I would say it's a tool, but not a toolbox, because if it was a toolbox, then you would use a different method to solve the judicial problem. It's very mechanistic, I would say.
This method?
Yeah.
I'm sorry, I don't find them.
I think there's too much detail here. Unless you all want to say it.
No, we want you to joke.
Yeah, I think it's unfair to...
So one guy says
to... Then those people who want to stay, yes, the joke is coming, but then those people who have more questions,
well,
Professor Sadrick,
yes, and this is, please stop photographing it. So this was about a Mr. Chen again.